Hey everyone, and welcome back to Scorncast, the official podcast of the Pop Scorn movie blog, which can be found at scornpop.blogspot.com. This is Jasper, I like hummus, and joining me today, and probably forever, is Ghostface Mella, a writer at the Roundtable Music blog. You can read him and download his weekly mixes at www.theroundtableonline.com. On this episode, we'll be discussing X-Men First Class, a superhero flick set in the early 1960s that explores the budding bromance and deadly dissension between James McAvoy's Professor X and Michael Fassbender's Magneto. What happens when, in the thick of the Cuban Missile Crisis, they stop being polite and start getting real? Roll that clip.
The real enemy is out there. I feel their guns moving in the water, targeting us. Go ahead, Charles. Tell me I'm wrong. Fire! Eric, you said yourself, we're the better men. This is the time to prove it. There are thousands of men on those ships that are just following orders.
I've been at the mercy of men just following orders. Never again.
So, Ghostface, you remember our summer preview Scorncast where I named X-Men First Class as my co-most anticipated movie of the summer, right?
Yes.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to remind you so that you don't get worried if I break down and cry during this segment.
Do you remember how it didn't make any of my list?
Yeah, I do. Weird how that turned out, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I felt like Tyra Banks when I was watching this. Like, I'm gonna... Because, you know, that episode of America's Next Top Model,
yeah,
the clip went viral where she was like, we were rooting for you. We were all rooting for you. Yeah, that was
true,
me.
We were. It's true.
That was me watching this movie.
Yeah. No, I felt like, so this was a completely different film as far as, like, Bryan Singer's attempt at bringing back Superman,
mm-hmm.
but it definitely had Bryan Singer's stamp of, like, let's make the old new again,
mm-hmm.
and I mean old as in, like, old style, like, 60s, 40s, 50s, you know, like, the look of it, let's make that new again, which, like, I was never really into that stuff, but that said, like, I felt the same exact way of, like, really? Like, I was rooting for this, you know? Like, I wanted this to be better, and you let me down. And I was going to give them leeway. I was going to be like, yeah, change some stuff around. Like, that's okay. But in the end, it still wasn't, it didn't benefit a better plot. It didn't benefit better character development. It was just to kind of make it easier for them, I think, to tell the story.
Yeah, at this point, I'm putting all my faith in Captain America, because,
ooh,
I know, it's dangerous,
like,
right?
A bad statement.
I don't know. I really don't see how Captain America could leave me more disappointed than I was with this movie, although...
Yeah, I will give you that. I think Captain America will be definitely more iconic than this movie, or at least more, like, in, you know, in the period sense, it will be more iconic, I hope, because Joe Johnston signed it. But I was very underwhelmed with this movie, and I was, you know, similarly underwhelmed with Thor, but I guess I was just whelmed, I think, with Thor, actually. but I was very underwhelmed with X-Men. I was expecting more between the relationship of Professor X and Magneto. I was expecting more of just kind of how they became to be. And I was expecting better, cooler superheroes that were either made up or actually existed in the 60s.
Yeah, that's the crutch right here for me. So I was really excited about seeing a superhero movie take place in a time period that lacks all the like the high-tech trappings and the bells and the whistles that we usually associate with the superhero genre. And also, I love the idea of revising, like, history lessons that everybody knows from high school with the intervention of comic book characters. And I feel like it just let me down in every regard. And it hurts. It hurts to admit that. But I felt really awkward watching this movie. I was cringing a lot.
Like what? Like, what were you cringing at?
Everything. I mean, I don't want to, like, hate on this movie too much because I don't necessarily think that it's deserving of hate, but it's definitely, like, deserving of, like, a 2-hour and 12-minute eye roll, or however long
yeah.
it is. But I guess my thing is, and I don't want to be committing nerd treason here, because I love seeing movies that have my favorite superheroes from my childhood, and my teen years, and my 20s, and my 30s. But I feel like, you know, we originally, in the first couple X-Men movies that came out, I'm going to ignore the third one for the time being, but in the first two, we got enough of, like, the backstory between Professor X and Magneto, in the same token that we got enough glimpses into what was going on with Wolverine. Like, we got enough taste of the whole mystery about Wolverine. And I feel like in the same regards that the Wolverine movie that came out 2 years ago, in the same regards that that was just kind of an unnecessary movie, this didn't necessarily, like, justify its presence at all.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So, I mean, I think we have enough of the Professor X and Magneto relationship in the first two films, but I think it could have added a little bit more to that dynamic. And
sure.
I think they tried, and it's not without, you know, not for nothing, but I think it kind of wrapped up in this one little montage, and it was very much like, oh, by the way, Professor X has unleashed his power, and now it's greater than ever before. And, I mean, I saw him do that for everyone in that montage, but, like, I was expecting more between him and Magneto. And I was expecting, and I have no idea what they plan to do with this supposed franchise, although it didn't open extremely strong. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they'll make more, but I don't know if they're going to fast-track it or whatever.
They also seem to kind of wrap up everything that they could possibly
yeah.
wrap up, right? Like, the ending of this movie is kind of bizarre in how it fast-tracks, like, every single major plot complication or, like, character relationship. I mean, if they don't make any more, this, I guess, builds a bridge to the other movies, fine. But it, at the same time, I found it weird that they didn't leave some things open for the sequel that they're bound to try to make.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think we even sat through the whole credits thinking that there might be another kind of Thor-type, you know,
yeah.
a post-ending ending, and there was nothing. And I remember everyone in the theater kind of groaning
yeah.
and just being like, well, that was stupid, you know, and not that the whole movie was stupid, but just that they sat there because the ending was kind of dissatisfying. And, you know, the ending ended on, like, a bald joke or something, you know, which was, like, the third or fourth bald joke.
Yeah, it really was, like, I think it was the fourth bald joke that they made.
Yeah, I was like, we get it, he's supposed to be Patrick Stewart later. Like, I get it, you know, but, like, I really didn't need to be reminded of it a million times because it just, like, totally discredited the believability of this movie and these characters.
Yeah.
Like, they had to continually remind you that they're going to be people you already know. And it wasn't in a cheeky, fun way. It was in this way that was like, hey, remember this thing from a couple of years ago? It wasn't fun for me to, like, discover that or be reminded of that. And I love the earlier movies. Like, I love them. I think X-Men 2 is probably one of the greatest superhero movies ever.
Yeah.
And I think it does such a good job of having an ensemble cast, each with their own stories, each progressing and having a decent bit of, like, character development, you know, without really leaving an action superhero movie. Like, it still remains true to that, and it's very entertaining, and it's accessible, and it's all those things, but then you're also learning about all these different people, you know, and Halle Berry has a really good accent in it. But I don't know, there was something about this one that tried so hard to be those earlier ones, but yet it felt so vacant comparatively. Like, it just didn't live up to them, and it tried so hard to be just like them.
Yeah, I found the whole thing pretty clunky. And one of the things that was really strange about it is there's a real lack of the kind of big action set pieces that you expect from this kind of movie. They do have, like, the big ending scene, which takes maybe 20, 25 minutes or whatever, and there's all sorts of, like, you know, action stuff that happens there. But throughout the movie, I just wondered if there were budget limitations, because to me, a lot of the special effects seemed unfinished. And the movie is really missing, like, I mean, all through the second X-Men movie in particular, there are action moments that you remember. And in this one, they kind of just save everything for the end. There's, like, a siege on the CIA headquarters where some of the mutants are being taught in the middle of the film, where the bad guys bust in and try to mess up the plan. But aside from that, I don't really remember much in the way of the kind of stuff that we go see an X-Men movie for.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think even that scene wasn't very action-y. The action wasn't portrayed in a way that was entertaining. It was just happening, and you almost weren't even seeing most of it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you saw Azazel, like, teleport and beat up a couple guys. That was kind of it.
Yeah, but it wasn't, like, it was almost like you're supposed to be these, like, sheltered teens or something who, like, are, you know, scared of this action, but, like, they're intrigued by it and, you know, whatever else. And I thought the last scenes were kind of, like, a letdown. You know, if the biggest thing was him pulling the submarine out of the water, then that was kind of, like, weak to me, mostly because it was in the trailer, and they made it seem like it was, like, one of many kind of, like, intense things that was going on. But, yeah, but then also when everything was flying around and it hit the beach and everything, it was just, like, I was kind of like, that's it? Like, I was expecting more, you know? And also, I'm not going to get into January Jones' acting, but I thought when she actually turned into, like, the Diamond Lady, I was like, this looks really bad. Like, it looked like it was, like, circa 2000 Mummy Returns, kind of, like, really, really glossy.
Oh, I would take it back even further. I would say TLC's Waterfalls video.
Okay, that's even better. Yeah. Even better. Yeah, I mean, it was, like, I think the Terminator 2 looked better than she did now. You know what I mean? Like, even still, that was just really poorly done, or the art direction was just very poor. I don't know which was which, but it was not good. And that was like, yeah, that was totally, I didn't think of it at the time, but now that you say it, I totally have this notion of, like, this feels rushed, you know? Like, I don't know if it was budget or just time, but the whole thing felt rushed. I mean, the pacing of it felt kind of rushed, but also just the production felt rushed to me.
Yeah.
You know, really no real character development, no, like, really digging into these people that we already know to show us how they became who they are. It was more of, like, just stupid little nods of, like, oh, you want to see Rebecca Romijn? Fine, here she is. You know, it was like, I was kind of like, that's not helping. You know, like, that's making the audience go, ooh, but it's not helping me. Right? You
know? Yeah, I found it really weird that the movie goes out of its way to link itself to the first three X-Men movies and the Wolverine movie, just because it does offer you, like, a lot of, like, cameos that you're like, oh, cool. You know, in some respect, I think the Wolverine scene is probably, like, the best thing in the movie, right? Like, the line, it's a good payoff for that scene.
I think for them to use the one F word, you know, in a PG-13 movie, that was the best time to use it.
Yeah, I agree. And it got a big laugh, and it played great. But at the same time, it's making all these connections to stuff that happened in the other movies, so that this whole series feels like one big continuum of movies. They really also shoot themselves in the foot in a big way, in several big ways, because I guess, I mean, if the movie Wolverine takes place after First Class, which explains how James McAvoy has aged into Patrick Stewart, why is Emma Frost a teenager in that movie?
Yeah.
And also, didn't the first sequence of X-Men 3 begin with Patrick Stewart walking into Jean Grey's house in the 90s? I think that's when the title card said it was set. So, like, if he was paralyzed in the 60s, I don't know. It makes me go cross-eyed thinking about it.
Yeah, no, there's too many of those things, and it was without getting, you're right, you're sticking to the movies. I was going to start talking about how Havoc is actually Cyclops' younger brother.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make any sense, but I mean, that, I think they were just playing with it, and you know, Darwin, I think, is, like, one of the newer X-Men, and so is Butterfly or Angel or whatever her name is, which, like, there's already a different Angel, so I don't know why we needed her, although I love Zoe Kravitz. I think she was kind of not really necessary. Yeah, like, they put their time into connecting these movies to the other ones in a way that was so lazy, and I don't know a ton of people that are as outraged as I am. But it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't a way that was, like, it would give an extra wink to people that really know, and it would just be fun for people that didn't. And I think the Wolverine scene is kind of fun for people who didn't know, but it's still kind of like, if you actually think about it, you're kind of like, wait a minute. But I think all the other stuff was just kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, if you care too much about these movies, if you know too much about them, you're going to be upset. So it's kind of like, my bother, you know, like, it was, and I was disappointed in that, because Bryan Singer helped with the story.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, all those little detail scenes were filled in by somebody else later, but I just didn't think, I want to blame the studio. I really just want to blame Fox, because I think that they rushed this, I think they didn't give it enough money, I think that they heard about Avengers, you know, whatever else, and they had changed the idea of this X-Men movie so many times that I think when they finally landed on it and they were like, let's make it a new franchise, let's get some younger kids in, you know, blah, 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 let's tie it back to the old, let's show them how they, you know, got better and, you know, whatever else. And I think it just became such a bastardized version of itself that when they finally got down to it, they were like, oh, crap, we need to release this thing, like, after Memorial Day. Let's get on this, you know? And I don't think any of the younger actors were really any good. No one really stuck out to me. I mean, I love Nicholas Holt, but when he finally became Beast, I was, like, laughing hysterically the whole time.
I would say, the transition was very, very jarring, but in some ways I feel like that was probably the best special effect in the movie, which isn't really saying a whole lot.
Yeah. Right? Like, yeah, I mean, just seeing him as, like, the blue teen wolf was, like, so ridiculous.
Yeah, when he walks into the airplane hangar or wherever they are.
I mean, it was just absurd. Like, yeah. I don't know if they were playing that for comedic effect, but, like, when he was walking in kind of slow-motion Armageddon style, it was, like, absurd to see his furry silhouette.
You know, there was a lot of this movie that I wasn't sure if they were playing for laughs or not.
Yeah, I couldn't tell.
Like, there's so much of this movie that feels really weird. There's a lot of training montages in this movie.
Yeah, and it's just a lot like of no montages. No one really had any real training. Like, no one was really up to snuff.
It's really weird because after the one training montage at Xavier's mansion, there's like a moment where Xavier says, "This has been a really cool week," or something to that effect, and I was like, "That was a week?"
Right, it's like, come on.
The use of time in this movie was really weird too, because I was unclear exactly how long Kevin Bacon as Sebastian Shaw and his like evil cohorts were on their submarine.
Yeah, I mean, I think they could have done a better job at making it like more of kind of like a period piece. I think like some of the clothes were okay, but like just I don't know, the feeling like they were trying, you know, when they showed the map and they showed like that weird not dream sequence but like in the head, they were trying to make it, you know, more kind of nostalgic feeling, like in the way that like the Indiana Jones movies were and stuff like that. But then they also tried to make it super hip and sleek and modern, you know, in like weird ways that it just didn't mesh. Like the filmmaking and then the actual like art direction or style of the film were totally different. They didn't work.
Why, when Charles Xavier was reading Emma Frost's mind, why did what was in her mind turn into, like, a news infographic from, like, ABC News Tonight?
Yeah, I don't know.
I feel like there were some really good performances that kind of got lost in the middle of all this, because I really did like, I liked...
January Jones?
No, I did not like January Jones. I didn't know that one of Emma Frost's mutant powers was being bored and unfazed by everything.
Right, yeah. I mean, I loved seeing Betty Draper outside of the house. I thought it was really good.
And I hate that, like, they took all these, like, female characters that are really significant in the comics, and actual characters in the comic books, and they turned them into not much of anything. And I feel kind of weird about this movie's attitude towards women in general. Like, I know it takes place in the 60s, but the movie doesn't really seem to have the attitude that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, you have January Jones. Emma Frost is a pretty interesting character, and seeing her be relegated to going up on top of the submarine to scrape some ice off for Sebastian Shaw's cocktail is pretty horrible.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, I just feel like it wasn't... I'm not that familiar with her, but, like, just from what I've heard and what I've seen in the Saturday morning cartoon, I thought she was way more badass.
Yeah, yeah.
Way smarter and sexier, but not in, like, a... I don't know, sexier in a different way. Like, not in such a cute, like, pin-up girl kind of way. More in, like, a I know who I am and you want this kind of thing.
Yeah, and I love Rose Byrne, but, I mean, she plays a CIA agent, and her big moment is taking all of her clothes off down to her underwear to infiltrate the Playboy Club. Like, it's just, oh, boy. And Mystique, who, again, is you know, a really memorable character from the comics, I'm not behind Jennifer Lawrence. I don't really get her as an actor. I didn't get her in Winter's Bone. And I felt like her whole pouty ingenue act in this movie was just kind of the wrong thing for Mystique. And I hated how, you know, Magneto basically is like, you should be yourself. And she's like, I'll sleep with you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that I just didn't, I mean, I in a weird way, like, I wanted her to be attracted to how, like, comfortable he was with being a mutant and stuff like that. But, like, at one point, she's not comfortable with herself, and she's telling, you know, Hank McCoy, Beast, to be comfortable with himself and his big feet or whatever, but yet she can never be blue. And then, you know, so that was kind of weird. And then, I don't know, like, just nothing, I felt like nothing worked for her. Like, she couldn't be pouty, she couldn't be sexy, and then when she kind of, like, finally decided to be, not evil, but, like, not, you know, try to be her own person, she didn't even, like, own that enough. And it, in this weird way, I was kind of like, well, maybe if there's a second movie, they'll delve more into her, and she'll have, you know, more, like, it'll be more of, like, the rise of Mystique kind of thing. But then even still, she's always been relegated to being Magneto's second-in-command, mm-hmm. you know, who he eventually kind of turns his back on. So I was kind of like, there is no redemption for her. Like, even in, you know, I mean, I think she's a very, like, powerful, you know, she has sweet moves, and she's got a hot bod, and she does a lot of cool stuff in the other movies, but I just thought it was kind of weak. And, like, but when she finally did use her power, you know, to act like Sebastian Shaw, like, it was like, oh, cool. You know, I don't know. I was expecting way more from her, considering what she becomes.
Yeah, and she uses her power once regarding, you know, in that moment in the end, with everyone else is using their mutant powers to fight. She does use hers to change and impersonate somebody, but only after she's told to stay on the plane, which is another great moment for women.
Yeah, I wasn't sure about, like, what they were trying to do with that, ever. You know, like, Moira essentially, you know, shoots him or whatever, like her ricochet, and, you know, Angel becomes evil immediately because she's already kind of had a hard life. Oh, and she's had a hard life because she was a stripper or a call girl or an escort or whatever. And I'm trying to think of, like, who else. There's not many females in this movie.
Mm-mm. Emma Frost was the only other major female role.
Right, and she's just problematic in and of herself. Yeah. I mean, the acting is, acting aside, I mean, she's, like, second in command to this guy who is, I mean, she's, I don't think she's perceived as more powerful than him in the film, but I think probably in real life she would have been.
Yeah,
she
yeah.
at least would have been his equal, you know?
She's one of those mutants that seems to have, like, 10 billion different powers just so that the story can be, you know, taken in certain directions, because she can change her skin to, like, an impenetrable diamond crust, and then she can, you know, read people's minds. She's got a pretty mixed bag.
Yeah, I mean, and, like, her, like, using her diamond power to, like, break the two-way mirror.
Oh, after she's whatever. Caught? Yeah.
And then be like, gentlemen, there's, like, gonna be a war and some junk. Like, it was kind of like, why don't you kill them? You know, or, like, why right. don't you break out?
Yeah.
And, like, it was almost like she was so bored. You know, like, she was just like, well, I'll just stay here.
And then
I'm like, why didn't she break out and find Magneto and is, like, finally, you know, someone who, like, really understands us or whatever?
Yeah.
I don't know. I was expecting way more from that.
And then she stays there. I mean, she disappears from the movie for, you know, what, 20, 25 minutes? And then the next time you see her is the last scene of the movie, and she's sitting there in her cell, even though she could have gotten up and made a hole in the wall and left.
I was so shocked. I was like, why is she still there? I was like, oh, is she going to break out? Or, like, was she helping them? Like, did she have a change of heart? I was so like, what is going on with this?
Yeah. And everything feels really rushed in this movie, and the big scenes don't have the impact that I think they're supposed to have, particularly in dealing with that scene we were talking about earlier where the bad guys have a siege on where the good guys are stationed. And it's supposed to be this really big dramatic moment when Angel, who is allied with the good guys, decides to go over and join the bad guys because of the case that Kevin Bacon makes for himself. It's just, you don't know anything about that character at all, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah, I was just like, okay, so we lost one. Like, whatever. You know, they killed off the black guy immediately. Like, the first chance they had, they killed him. And, you know, this woman that we just met, who is also a person of color, just immediately turns evil. Like, without a second thought, it's just like, okay, see you guys, bye. You know, like, I was just like, what is going on here? I didn't understand that. And then, you know, her power was, like, just kind of lame. And I think she's, like, a real superhero, or, you know, she's a real in the X-Men universe. But I think there's just a huge arsenal that they could have pulled from, and to have used those two people I think was really bad.
What works on the comic page might not necessarily work in movies, because I know that some of these characters are, well, all of these characters I think are based on characters that exist in the Marvel Universe. They're adapted somewhat, but to me, like, the worst moment of this film was when, in the final climactic showdown where everybody's fighting, Angel, who has, like, dragonfly wings, and she can spit, like, some sort of acid fire or something like that. So she's flying after Banshee, and she's, like, you know, zipping through the air and spitting on him. And Banshee, who is a character who can keep himself suspended in air by sort of, like, gliding, and then when he gets too close to the surface of anything, he can, like, sonically scream and boost himself back up. That whole scene was ridiculous.
Yeah, it was ridiculous, and it wasn't it was at that point that, and I don't know if it was just because their superpowers were bad, but, like, that was when I was like, oh, right, it's the 60s. You know, like, they didn't pick people with, like, really interesting powers, and the people that did have interesting powers, like Magneto and stuff, like, he used them in the exact same way that he always had, or he, like, not even as sophisticated as he had before, which, like, that makes sense to me. But, like, they could have had other people that had their powers and knew how to use them and did all this stuff and, like, actually had cool powers. But instead it was like, oh, she flies and she sits and stuff. And, like, oh, yeah, he can, like, scream really loud. And although banshees are Irish, he's not because whatever. So let's just make him a ginger.
Yeah, it was like it was like Jim Henson's X-Men babies.
Basically.
And I feel like all the mutants here, there are some that we've seen in other movies, and they're using their powers in exactly the same way. And the ones that are new, you're not really getting anything new, because most of those people have powers that are comparable to things that we've seen in the other movies, like Havoc.
Right.
I mean, he kind of has the same exact power as Cyclops, except it just comes from a different part of his body.
And he kind of can't control it.
Which was the whole thing with Cyclops. So I have some questions that I would like to get your input on.
Okay.
Emma Frost can change her skin into one of the hardest substances known to man, yet she can be cracked into submission by a brass rail.
So, this is the exact thing that I said last night, which is, like, diamonds are, one, a girl's best friend, and two, they're forever, unless that forever is matched by a metal, shitty bed frame. Like, I mean, come on.
Yeah, he probably got it at Home Goods. It's not very sturdy, you know? I mean, ugh. So Charles Xavier, in the end of the movie, spoiler alert, I think we probably spoiled this movie enough, erases the mind of Moira McTaggart, who is the only CIA agent who knows what's going on and what's happened all through the movie. And he erases her mind so she can't tell her superiors where he is, because he's wanted by authorities, and all the mutants that he's teaching are located. Do you think that he thought that maybe they might come looking for him at his gigantic family estate?
Yeah, I wasn't sure of, like, how established that was, like, I mean, from, you know, the one scene we had where Mystique shows up at his place, like, I wasn't like, and then, you know, and then they showed up there and you were like, oh, this is, like, his place. So, yeah, everybody else knew his name. I don't know, I thought it was very strange.
Obviously, they're going to start by saying, who is this person that we want, and where does he live, and we'll start there. So, maybe the end credits scene should have been the authorities knocking on the door and him answering it and being like, oh, shit.
Yeah, or even, like, erasing their memories or something. I don't know. Yes. Like, or him making it look like it's not even there.
Yeah.
A shadow or something.
Yeah, he's going to have to erase a lot of memories by the time all this is said and done. So, I have one more question, but it's a whopper.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about Beast. How old is Beast supposed to be, do you think?
I think he's probably, like, 18 or 19.
Okay, I'm glad you said that, because he's really efficient. But he's, like, he's really efficient. I mean, I might have missed a few things, but from what I gather, he's an expert on neurology, electrocephalography, look it up, genetics, biology, hematology, aeronautic engineering, and fashion design, right?
Right.
Because, okay, so listen, he builds Mini Cerebro to amplify Professor X's telepathy so he can find mutants. He creates a special technology to harness Havoc's energy blasts, or whatever that is. He makes a pseudo-mutant antidote serum out of Mystique's blood. And he designs the early version of the X-Jet, which he also pilots fairly skillfully. And he found time in between doing all this stuff to make their costumes.
Yeah, and I never understood, I mean, me personally, I never understood if him being smart was part of his power, or if he became that way. And one of the things that I was told was that he was actually kind of like a bumbling idiot, but he was like getting smarter, or he was like goofy and kind of dopey, and that he was getting smarter, but that when he took the serum or whatever, that it accelerated his mutant abilities, which were also intelligence. So I found it interesting, and I don't know if that's right, that's just what I heard based on mythology, whatever. But I thought it was interesting that he was already really smart and just had to, as this one man in the theater said, what he got, hand feet? That's what his power was. Which I thought that made the film for me, when the guy sitting next to me said, what he got, hand feet? And I thought, yeah, that is his power, hand feet. But it turns out that he's also really smart and, yeah, really, really efficient. He knows everything and can do anything.
But his hand feet make him run really fast.
Right, really fast.
Which...
He can hang upside down.
Does that make any sense?
No, it didn't make any sense to me. Like, none of that stuff made any sense. I mean, like, it just... Like, I was watching the movie and I was following it only because it was very simple to follow, yeah. But not in a way that was, like, entertaining. I don't know. I can't even explain. But, I mean, I just... Yeah, I was just not with Beast at all. And it made me... I love Nicholas Holt, and I think he actually acted it okay.
Perhaps. Yeah, I liked... He played Beast as kind of like this gee-whiz science nerd from the 60s. I really liked his approach to that.
I liked it, too, but I also think he was kind of, like, weirdly bipolar, like, in a way, which yeah. I was just kind of like, oh, maybe he's just trying to be a teenager or something, or, like, some of his, like, skin stuff is kind of rubbing off. But there was something about, like... Just him being Beast. Like, maybe we just saw him too early into the transition and he just, like, wasn't cool with it yet, or he just wasn't, I don't know, like, he was too jealous, he was too, like, ragey, like, there was just too much going on with him that I was just like, where is this character really going? You know, where is, like, what's really going on with this guy? And I couldn't tell, I don't know.
I kept waiting for the climax to involve him running really fast.
Right, because he learned that, right?
Right, like, I kept waiting for... I was like, well, this has to come back in the movie, obviously. He's going to, like, race to save somebody in the end. Like, there's going to be a scene where somebody needs to, like, be pulled out of something really quickly, and they're going to call on him to do that. And it's never brought up again.
Yeah, never again.
Yeah.
Never again. And I feel like really no one used their powers, like, to save the day. I mean, if anything, Mystique saved the day by just silencing Azazel. For, you know, for that, or just, you know, kind of sedating him for, like, a second long enough for Beast to get him. But I didn't think, like, I thought Havoc was like, kind of weak. I thought Banshee, I mean, Banshee has a stupid power, but, like, that was just kind of weak. Like, he flew around, and then his glider got a hole in it, and then he was done. Like, it was just, I don't know. I feel like no one really excelled at anything.
Yeah, there's a plot point in the middle of the movie where Charles Xavier comes back from being away and he finds that all of these young mutants that he's taken on have, like, destroyed the little CIA headquarter base that they have. Like, they've ruined a statue, they've broken out a wall and everything by using all their powers. And he sort of, like, admonishes them for, you know, being irresponsible and not being grown-ups. And it just made me wonder, what kind of mutant was he looking for? If he can find mutants using the test version of Cerebro that Beast builds him, why wasn't he going out and finding, like, adult mutants that actually have, you know, responsibility and care for the possessions of others?
Yeah, I wondered that same thing, and I think it's only because the studio was like, no, make them younger. No,
yeah.
Make them younger. You know, like, and just like, if we have to make another one of these, we don't want to start with 35, 40-year-old actors, you know, whatever it is. And I think that's the only reason, which I think is a really crappy reason. And it doesn't make for a good, kind of believable story that, like, these are actually kids.
So, if you were giving X-Men First Class a grade, what grade would you give it?
I would give it a C+.
Yeah, I got nervous because I would actually only go a little bit lower than you. I would go C, and I was worried that I would have to, like, justify my C because we really kind of focused on all the things that were wrong with this movie rather than the stuff that worked. But I do think that some of the performances really helped carry you through this movie. And I thought that Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy did, even though their interaction is sort of clunky, they do have a really good chemistry that should have been put to use in a better movie.
Yeah, let's actually talk about their chemistry for a little bit, because I kind of wanted them to make out. I think I'm the only one. And it's not that I find them both attractive, which they are, but really it was the way that they played them.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, wow, Bryan Singer, like, what did you put into this script? Like,
yeah.
Kind of undertones did you put in? But, like, really, I mean, I understand they're supposed to be the best of friends, and they've shared a lot, and he sees inside his mind, and they cry together, and it's really nice. But, like, at the end of the day, you know, he ran after him, and, you know, they embraced in a way that, like, it was very romantic, you know? It was like they had an affection for each other that, you know, I don't think, you know, hey, it's the 60s, you know, go to town. But they didn't really do any of that, and the way that they hinted at, you know, like, it was like their love for each other was greater than friends, I feel.
And then Thor accidentally, like, walks into the room, and he's like, oh, sorry, I didn't realize you guys were together.
Right, he was like, oh, someone needed a hammer, and then it was like... I think that's the sequel I want to see.
Well, I'm sure you're seeing it frequently inside your head. And that's going to do it for another episode of Scorncast. Thanks to Ghostface Milla for stopping by, thanks to Bug for our theme music, and just a reminder, you can visit PopScorn at scornpop.blogspot.com, and you can email PopScorn at scornpop@gmail.com. And hey Beast, about that fashion design thing? Those bulletproof X-Men costumes you made? Not so bulletproof, huh? Don't give up that science stuff, okay?